Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
This is To the Point.
Guantanamo Bay and the War on Terror. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay was clearly abusive and contrary to everything we were ever taught about American values. That comes not from a human rights group, but the recently retired General Counsel for the United States Navy. Tony Blair and Angela Merkel have been critical of Guantanamo Bay. A United Nations report says it ought to be shut down. On To the Point, what makes a captive an enemy combatant? How long can he be held without charge? What constitutes abusive treatment? And what is the role of Guantanamo in the war on terror? On Reporter's Notebook later on, controversial cases at the new Supreme Court. First, here's the news.
Contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Olney, back with To the Point. The Navy's top lawyer warned the Bush Pentagon that new rules were an invitation to abuse of prisoners. That was 2 years before the Abu Ghraib scandal. On To the Point, more on Alberto Mora's fight to change policy and UN recommendations that Guantanamo Bay's detention facility be closed. On Reporter's Notebook, late-term abortion, the Clean Water Act, and two new justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. First, this news update. An execution scheduled for San Quentin Prison early this morning has been postponed at least till this evening. A federal judge gave California the option of having two doctors present to make sure that the lethal injection of three drugs was not cruel and unusual punishment. At the last minute, the doctors walked out. Henry Weinstein covers legal affairs for the Los Angeles Times. Henry, good to have you on our program.
Good morning, Warren. Always nice to be with you. I'd like to emphasize that perhaps more than any other time that I've been on your shows over the years, I'm going to be a bit circumspect since we have a moving situation at the moment. And this, I think California is about to have something. Well, clearly, the presence of two doctors in an execution chamber last night would have been a first, and what may happen today will apparently be a first also.
All right. Let us tell our listeners around the country that we are speaking just before noon California time. Now, there are three drugs involved in the lethal injection here. The last two stop involuntary muscle movement and then finally stop the heart. They would be very painful. So the first is supposed to put the convict to sleep, and that's where the issue has arisen.
That is correct. The lawyers for Michael Morales, the man scheduled to be executed, argued that that there was no guarantee that the drug would be administered properly, and that if the drug was not administered properly, that the person could suffer a painful and cruel death, and because of the fact that his muscle movement had been severely affected by the second drug, that people wouldn't actually know. So they filed a legal challenge, saying that the California procedure as put into effect, and they presented some evidence from prior executions that they'd taken longer than was anticipated, or that a person had continued to breathe longer than had been anticipated under the protocol. And the judge said, that there were substantial questions raised. So the judge gave, California two options. One was to have some anesthesiologists present for the procedure, or in the alternative, to simply use the first drug, the very, strong barbiturate, and use it for a longer period of time. And California initially opted for the, to use the anesthesiologist.
Okay. Now, the California Medical Association objected very strongly to that. Apparently, the two doctors chosen did, too, because they walked out at the last minute. The Hippocratic Oath being part of the issue here, the doctors should first do no harm. So the doctors are out of the picture. Now they have the option, as you said, of administering only the first drug, the one that puts the prisoner to sleep. What would the consequences of that be?
Well, what I think it's unclear what the consequences would be. One immediate consequence, apparently, is that it would take much longer for the execution to occur. I mean, the estimates ranged from initially that an execution would take 10 to, you know, to 15 minutes, and on this they're estimating 30 to 45 minutes. No one really knows, of course, because California has never done this before.
So it would amount to an overdose, a huge overdose of barbiturates, is that right?
That's correct. And then I guess some people, I think, would view this as an irony that it's sort of like a mercy killing at the end of life with somebody who was, you say, you know, having a doctor-physician, you know, a doctor-assisted suicide, but normally executions aren't conducted in that way. And, you know, and it's obviously not known in the case of this person how he will react to that amount of barbiturate.
So we don't know now if that's what California is going to try to do, if the federal judge involved would approve of that. In the meantime, if, in fact, the warrant for his execution, Michael Morales' execution, runs out, which would happen at midnight, then it would go back to the federal judge who originally presided over the case. And he's been saying
Let me stop you for just a second. There's several judges involved in this. The judge who had expressed reservations about the execution going forward, Judge McGrath in Ventura County, he is a state court judge who originally presided over trial, and he's the one that urged Governor Schwarzenegger unsuccessfully to grant clemency to Morales.
If the execution doesn't happen, it would go back to him.
Oh, that is correct. It would go back to him. California has scheduled the execution for 7:30 this evening, which is 4.5 hours earlier than executions are normally conducted here. The belief is that's to give them a window of time to complete the execution before the warrant runs out at 12:01 a.m. Tomorrow.
All right.
So they'd have a longer period of time in case there was a problem that arose.
Once again, very much a story that is in process as we speak, but it's being watched all over the country because the issue of lethal injections being cruel and unusual punishment is being adjudicated in other places as well. Henry Weinstein, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Los Angeles Times legal affairs writer. In a moment, has Guantanamo Bay outlived its usefulness? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Worman, I'll be back with To the Point. President Bush has said repeatedly that the U.S. does not torture so-called enemy combatants in the war on terror. But a former general counsel for the Navy, a Bush appointee, says there is no moral or practical distinction between official Pentagon policy and authorization of torture. Alberto Mora was interviewed by Jane Mayer for this week's New Yorker magazine. Jane, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Now, Mr. Mora did not just say this since his retirement. He spent a couple of years trying to change policy from inside the Pentagon. Tell us about that.
That's right. Really, it started a long time ago, long before Abu Ghraib pictures came out. He began to hear reports from agents working for the Navy that there was brutality taking place down in Guantanamo. So it would have been about December 2002 he began hearing reports that things were going wrong. And he took it to heart. I mean, he really cared a lot, and he tried very hard from the inside to change the policy. And what he came across was a brick wall of resistance going right up to the top of the Pentagon and over to the vice president's office.
Did he get the impression while this was going on that he was, in fact, being listened to and that policy was likely to change?
Well, he did. And he did have some effect. I think, there's a quote in the story where someone from the Navy is saying that America has a lot to thank Alberto Mora for. He did push back the Pentagon from using some of the harsher methods that we saw in the very beginning in Guantanamo, things like unending isolation and the use of dogs were banned after he spoke up against it. But there was kind of a strange bureaucratic process that maybe only Washington can understand, where Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld put together a group, including the critics like Alberto Mora, inside the Pentagon to study what they should be doing. And then basically they ignored all their recommendations for the most part, and found lawyers elsewhere in the Justice Department who told them they could do pretty much much anything they wanted to do, and they listened to the lawyers they wanted to hear from.
Now, one of the things that Mora wanted was to institute prior practice, which had been to treat prisoners in accordance with the Geneva Conventions.
Yeah, he really felt that from the start it was a mistake to toss the Geneva Conventions overboard. I mean, what he was looking for, what he was trying to push the Pentagon to do, was to embrace some clear standard that involved banning cruelty from the way the U.S. would treat detainees. He argued very eloquently, really, that for the U.S. government to endorse and authorize cruelty is just a complete contradiction of American values and of the Constitution, which bans such things. And so he tried very hard to get a clear standard that soldiers on the ground would understand, so that they wouldn't have situations such as we've had in Abu Ghraib. He basically saw the lack of clarity as an invitation to abuse, and he warned everybody in the Pentagon, this is going to happen. Bad things are going to happen if we can't get a clear standard.
What was his feeling when he did see what had happened at Abu Ghraib and when it became an international scandal?
Oh, I think he says he was horrified. He was stunned, dismayed. You know, he basically thought by that time, you'll have to read this, the New Yorker has put the actual 22-page secret history of this whole period up on our website, and anyone interested should go take a look at it, because he thought at that point that he had won. He and the other critics inside the Pentagon were under the impression that they had won the day inside. And the reason they were under that impression was that Rumsfeld and his chief counsel, whose name is William Haynes, never told the critics that they had lost. They never showed them what the policy was. After getting them involved, they secretly made a decision, signed it, and authorized the people who were in charge of interrogations to use all kinds of methods that are outside of what we usually think of as allowed. But they never told the critics, so these guys did not understand what was going on until Abu Ghraib broke.
And at that meeting, where it was said to be under consideration, the meeting which led to the report that was apparently ignored, I gather from your story that some lawyer suggested, that if in fact we went back and established the Geneva Conventions as the standard, then those who have been interrogating prisoners in the very recent past might be charged with war crimes.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's stunning to hear what's been going on inside some of the top counsels inside the Pentagon. I mean, there've been meetings just this past fall, really, where again Alberto Mora and others have been pushing very hard to at least adopt as policy the clear standards of Geneva. And what you'll hear from when you read it, what you see is the people inside the Bush administration and inside the Pentagon are saying, well, if we adopt those standards now, we may be held in violation of them, which means we could be charged with crimes, war crimes, basically. So they see this as a liability. They can't return to the rule of law once they've been outside of it.
Here's Jane Mayer with The New Yorker magazine. She mentioned that the 22-page secret history will be posted on their website. That is, in fact, not her writing, but the writing of Alberto Mora, who himself drafted this 22-page history of what he was attempting to do. Today, at the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense, Mr. Rumsfeld, was asked about this report. Here's a portion of what he said.
You know, I expect to have differing views. It's my responsibility to listen to differing views and to make judgments, and I do. And when after the facts, it turns out that there's concern about it that concerns me, then I'm happy to rescind it and take another fresh look at it and talk to more people about it and see what ought to be done.
So, Jane Mayer, back to you. It was apparent that the Secretary was beginning to take another look, but he didn't then follow the recommendations of this committee. Does that suggest that anything happened that's different from what we just heard him say?
Well, I mean, I hope he's talking about taking a fresh look now. It's hard to tell what he's saying exactly. I mean, at the time, what happened was interesting. Rumsfeld's point of view, when he was told by the General Counsel of the Navy that what the U.S. is doing to detainees is verging on torture, and Rumsfeld's reaction position was, that's not torture. One of the things he was making, he basically kind of joked around about it and said, you know, people will say that if you just stand for 4 hours a day, that's torture, but I stand for 8 hours a day. And somebody in his office had to kind of quietly say, well, sir, you're allowed to sit down when you want, so it might be different. But he was not overly concerned at the time. That seems true.
And that's what you're getting that from, this 22-page history written by Mr. Mora, the former general counsel of the Navy.
I am, and some additional reporting that I did about it. The thing is, Rumsfeld did push back. They did get rid of a few of the things that really all around the world are viewed as torture, such as waterboarding people, which is sort of half drowning them. They ruled out a few of the things that are so obviously illegal that there was really no way you could legalize them. But they left open the possibility that they could do that and even torture people outright if the president ordered it. They said that it would be legal for the president to order torture if he wanted to and if he thought it was a military necessity.
And that came from Mr. Yu, who was in the Office of the General Counsel in the Department of Justice.
Yes, this came from John Yu, who was a deputy in the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department. And what's interesting is that the General Counsel Alberto Mora at the Navy told the Pentagon, you shouldn't listen to this point of view that you was propounding. That he said, you know, he describes it in this memo as catastrophically wrong, and he says, you know, you could be held liable if you follow this advice because it's wrong, and eventually what happened was Mora was proven right. They withdrew that memo. It took almost a year, but at a certain point, somebody else came into the Justice Department, took a look at it, and said, oh my God, we can't follow this, and they threw it out.
But all right. Jane Mayer, once again, a staff writer at The New Yorker, having reported on the 22-page memo available on The New Yorker website written by Alberto Mora when he was the general counsel of the Navy. And once again, that's a political appointment by the president of the United States. We don't have time to go into it here, but he was a very person very supportive of the president, supportive of the war on terror, and a person with an interesting background, which you can read about in her article. David Rivkin is a partner now in a private legal office in Washington. He's an expert on international law and served in the Department of Justice and the White House during the Reagan and first Bush administrations. And David Rivkin, thanks for being on our program.
Good to be with you.
Are you concerned, based on what we have heard about the report of what Mr. Mora was saying while he was in the Pentagon?
No, I mean, quite frankly, I'm concerned more by the twisting and misinterpretation of a very complex legal and policy narrative that, with all due respect to Jane, I've heard and I've read most of a pretty lengthy New Yorker article. I'm happy to address the substance, but I think, frankly, what I've heard described in the last 10 or 15 minutes is a very substantial misrepresentation of what actually happened.
All right. As you have just made reference to, we don't have a lot of time, but was the misinterpretation Jane Mayer's, or was it Alberto Mora when he wrote this 22-page memo?
I think it's mostly the misinterpretation. Let's assume it's with the best of intentions, but as I said, by the reporters, by the New Yorker, it's a very complex narrative. Let me tell you again, there's nothing new, particularly newsworthy, in the information that Mr. Mora, whom I actually I've not talked about this matter, but known for many years and in the past, I consider to be a very honorable man and a good lawyer. He took a position which reasonable people can take, which I fundamentally think is not compelled, certainly as a legal matter and bad as a matter of policy, that we should subject unlawful enemy combatants, individuals who manifestly are not covered by Geneva Conventions, covered by customary international law, not in some law-free zone, entitled to be treated humanely, but not subject to the manifold protections of Geneva, which are for honorable people, for lawful combatants, to acknowledge the fact that they behave lawfully in combat, because there's a connection between how you behave prior to capture and how you get treated. That those protections, which, by the way, are so wonderful, never been accorded to anybody, certainly not America's, are so wonderful, but not only you cannot be mistreated, you cannot even be bribed, you cannot be offered oranges or cigarettes to betray military secrets, guess why? Because you have a right to keep those secrets. So these are honorable people we're talking about. His view was that we should treat people who are manifestly not entitled to it in the same way, because if we introduce new standards, there would be confusion, there would be problems, and some abuses are going to result.
He said actually that if you don't make the appropriate distinctions, that the Constitution itself is what's ultimately violated, because it says that every human being has rights that aren't bestowed by the state or the laws, even the Constitution itself.
I have no doubt that that is an honestly held view in Mr. Moore's part. I would submit to you that there's enormous difference between taking the position that you either kind of an absolutist position, legally and morally, that you're entitled to the manifold protections of Geneva. And by the way, very important for viewers to appreciate, if you're entitled to full Geneva protections, not only you cannot be subjected to any kind of coercion, as I said, you cannot be bribed or jollied into revealing any information, you're supposed to have access to athletic equipment. So if folks who are having Guantanamo wanted to have baseball bats so they can play baseball, wanted to have a hierarchy within the camp so they can sort of report to their own fellows, if they wanted to get salaries, that's what Geneva Conventions of 1949 provide for.
Okay, but back to your first point, it seems to me that you're quarreling not with Jane Mayer's interpretation of Mr. Mora, but with what Mr. Mora himself said. And one of the quotes that she has from him is that what was going on at Guantanamo Bay was contrary to everything we were ever taught about American values.
Okay, but now, all right, what I'm quibbling with, first of all, I'm trying to tell you that Mr. Mora is coming from a particular position, which I can respect, which I don't agree, in part because, leave aside the instrumental issues about do we really want to give baseball bats to people in Guantanamo, do we really want to put ourselves in a position we cannot interrogate
them? I don't think he was advocating that.
No, but I'm saying to you as a lawyer, and I'm quite familiar with Geneva Conventions, if you take the view that everybody's entitled to full benefits of Geneva, the United States has no legal basis to deprive people detained in Guantanamo of access to any sports equipment of their choice, including, hockey pucks and sticks and baseball bats. Okay? That's absurd. Point number two, I believe that it is possible to come up with the standards for interrogation that are neither cruel and inhumane and degrading, nor torture, less protective than ones for POWs, that enable us to maintain the distinction, symbolically very important, between lawful and unlawful combatants, and interrogate them. Mr. Moore obviously did not. The problem of Jane's account is that she does not allow for the possibility that any deviation from Geneva does not necessarily result in cruelty.
Well, here's the way, though, that they were treating one of the suspects at Guantanamo Bay. 160 days of isolation in a pen perpetually flooded with artificial light, 48 days of interrogation at 18 to 24 hours in a stretch. He was stripped naked, straddled by taunting female guards, forced to wear women's underwear, put on a bra, threatened by dogs. What about that? Isn't that something less than the Constitution and the Geneva Conventions would call humane treatment?
If what you describe were the totality of treatment inflicted upon this individual in the time space you provided, I would not be comfortable with it. It is not torture, but it probably, in my opinion, would be cruel, degrading, inhumane treatment.
Okay, well, Mr. Morris says there's no difference. I'm going to interrupt you simply because, in the interest of time, we have to take a break. We'll come back, and I'll let you make your point, David Rifkin. We'll continue this conversation with him and Jane Mayer and other guests as well on Reporter's Notebook later, to controversial cases at the newly constituted U.S. Supreme Court. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere in the war on terror. And the report today has just come out in the New Yorker magazine, the report this week, I should say, of the 22-page memo written by Alberto Mora, the former General Counsel of the Navy, objecting to the policies of the Defense Department. David Rifkin is formerly with the Department of Justice in the White House in the Reagan and first Bush administrations. And, Mr. Rifkin, I interrupted you. Let me go ahead and let you finish your point.
I'll be very brief. What bothers me enormously is the moral and sort of legal absolutist of the critics, because one can indeed construct a set of interrogation routines that are effective, that can only be applied to lawful combatants, but do not amount to torture and inhumane and degrading treatment. And at least what I would do, I would basically apply the same set of procedures with the same intensity, we apply to our own people in basic training, which is modicum of stress techniques, as we all know. Frequently, a drill sergeant, if you're not performing well, will tell you, put you in parade rest and full combat gear, not for 8 hours, not for 10 hours, but for 4 or 5 hours, tell you to drop down and give somebody, him 200 or 300 push-ups, would yell at you, you're not eating great food, you go about sleep during the hell week. I mean, the kind of things we do to our own people certainly can be done to unlawful combatants. The problem of the critics, it's all or nothing. As far as they're concerned, we should treat people whom we capture in combat, who are unlawful combatants, who have committed atrocities, who pose a grave threat to humanity, the way we treat criminal defendants. And that's absurd. And there's very little effort to try to come up with common ground and try to come up with techniques which we're all comfortable.
Okay, David Rifkin, once again, now a private attorney in Washington. David Coles, professor of law, Georgetown University, legal affairs correspondent for The Nation, and a volunteer staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, author of several books on the on subjects related to what we're talking about today. And Professor Cole, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Are we talking here about moral absolutism as opposed to a more flexible approach to prisoners in this very strange situation where there are no states involved and where enemy combatants are sort of freelancers working, in this case, for al-Qaeda?
Well, to some extent, we are talking about moral absolutism, but that's because there are some moral absolutes. One of them is that you never torture. That is a moral absolute that we've accepted by adopting the International Convention Against Torture and Cruel and Inhuman and Degrading Treatment that we've put into practice with a criminal statute. That makes it a crime under all circumstances, and that prohibition is accepted by the world. It is considered one of the most basic prescriptions known to mankind. So yes, there are some moral absolutes, and I just listened to David Rifkin suggest that what we ought to be guided by is what we do when we are subjecting our own people to basic training. That's crazy. We waterboard people in basic training in order to prepare them for the possibility that they may be tortured by others. But that doesn't mean that we accept that they can be tortured by others or that that's a permissible practice. And it's very different, of course, to be subjected to something like waterboarding or any of these other tactics by your friends in an exercise that you know is fake, and to be subjected to it by the enemy in a situation where you have no control whatsoever.
Do you think there is a fundamental misunderstanding here of the issues involved by either Alberto Mora, the former general counsel of the Navy, or Jane Mayer, the reporter for The New Yorker?
No, I think they understand exactly what's at issue, and I think people like David, with all due respect, he's a very good lawyer, but what he seeks to do here is to defend at every point what the administration is doing by obfuscating what's going on. And I think what we've seen here couldn't be clearer. We had a situation where from day one, the administration made a determination that we are not going to treat these people humanely because we have detained so many of them. We don't know who the bad guys are. We've detained so many of them. Now we've got to interrogate them, and we've decided that we're going to use coercive tactics to interrogate them. And every step of the way, what they did was try to muddy the waters with respect to the absolute moral prohibition on torture to permit this kind of conduct to go on. And so you see the treatment of Mr. Al-Qahtani that you described just a moment ago at Guantanamo. You see the pictures at Abu Ghraib, and there's a direct line between the decision by the administration that we are going to coerce information out of these people and the photographs that you see at Abu Ghraib and the account from an army interrogation log of Mr. Al-Qahtani's treatment, which included, one of the things you didn't mention, was he was injected with IV fluid and then not allowed to go to the bathroom so that he urinated on himself repeatedly.
Let me ask you this. Is there, as David Rifkin seems to be hoping for, some sort of middle ground here, particularly with regard to people who are classified as enemy combatants rather than prisoners of war?
Yeah, I think there really is a middle ground. And I think the real shame here is that the administration failed to take the middle ground and instead overreached and took such an extreme position. And I think it's really an example of them failing to think about the long-term consequences. Just as we went into Iraq failing to think about the long-term consequences, we treated the people at Guantanamo failing to think about the long-term consequences. So a middle ground would be to say, look, we're in a justifiable military conflict with al-Qaeda. That means we can hold people who are fighters for al-Qaeda, but we have to do certain things. We have to provide them with hearings to make sure they are, in fact, fighters for al-Qaeda. We refused to do so until the Supreme Court ruled against the administration. We have to define fighter for al-Qaeda narrowly. We've refused to do so. Instead, employed a definition of enemy combatant that includes a Swiss grandmother who sends money unknowingly to a group that turns out to be a front for al-Qaeda. And then you've got to treat them humanely. And you can't torture them, and you can't coercively interrogate them. And had we done that, Guantanamo would not be the black mark that it has become on the United States' reputation. And had we done that, we could solve the problem of Guantanamo by holding accountable, through military tribunals, fair military tribunals, those people who are actually fighting for al-Qaeda. But because we overreached, because we treated them in these kinds of ways, we've effectively immunized them from trial, and not one person has yet been brought to trial of the 520 people who are held on Guantanamo.
David Cole with at Georgetown University and The Nation magazine and the Center for Constitutional Rights. Back to David Rifkin. What about it? Would that be a satisfactory middle ground? You said yourself you were uncomfortable with some of the things that have been done at Guantanamo.
No, unfortunately, my good friend David Cole, who also is an excellent lawyer, did not come up with a middle ground. He basically suggested, and it's very important to unpack it, no coercive interrogations whatsoever. That would make, leaving aside the question of who is an enemy combatant or not and what level of due process you get. Let's leave it aside. We're really talking about interrogation now. No coercive techniques at all would mean treating those people as lawful enemy combatants who upon capture become POWs. That has not been the law of war for hundreds of years, and for a very good reason. You want to incentivize, let's forget about losing intelligence here. You want to incentivize people to behave lawfully prior to being captured. By following Professor Cole's suggestion, we're basically legitimizing unlawful combatancy, which has been a scourge of humanity in the 14th century and remains that in the 21st century.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to get to the UN report if I can, although this conversation is so interesting and it's been difficult to get past it. But David Cole, back to you. What about this? Is there some important distinction that needs to be made between POWs in the traditional sense and the people we're talking about at Guantanamo Bay?
Well, there is, and here's the distinction. You cannot punish a prisoner of war for fighting in the war. You can punish an illegal combatant. You can hold him criminally accountable. You can sentence him to life in prison. You can even sentence him to death for war crimes. Anyone who's fighting for al-Qaeda is committing a war crime.
Well, can you coercively interrogate him?
No, you can't coercively interrogate him. And nothing in the laws of war has ever said it's permissible to coercively interrogate an unlawful combatant. What it has said is it's permissible to try and punish unlawful combatants, and it's not permissible to try and punish those who are lawful combatants. That's the distinction. There's no precedent whatsoever for the notion that, well, just because we think they're bad guys, we can go ahead and coercively interrogate them.
All right. Very fundamental difference here. Jane Mayer, back to you with the New Yorker magazine. Is it your understanding from your interview and from reading Mr. Mora's 22-page document that he is saying there can be no coercive interrogation at all, ever?
Well, you know what I wanted to say was, as somebody who's been writing about the subject for a while, you know, I interview a lot of the people who are interrogators, and the people who are close to these interrogations, doing the interrogations, including the people in this memo who were working for the Navy Criminal Investigative Service, who were down on the ground in Guantanamo, are the ones who are most against the coercive interrogations. They say it doesn't work. And, you know, you hear very political sort of ideological lawyers who for some reason feel for political reasons they don't like maybe international legal standards, and they're in favor of sort of maximum flexibility. That's why they want to be able to use these sort of brutal methods, because they think the U.S. shouldn't be stopped from doing what it wants to do. But what's interesting is, on a practical level, talk to the interrogators, they will tell you it doesn't work anyway. Talk to the FBI, they're the ones who really have interrogation experience much more than the military does. They'll tell you you're not going to get good information. And in this case, what Alberto Mora was reacting to were naval investigators. They're not people who have a political axe to grind one way or the other. They're people on the ground who are soldiers who are saying, this stuff doesn't work, and it's disturbing, and we don't want to be part of it. It's corrupting. It corrupts sort of, you know, the military's sense of itself and its mission and taking the high moral ground in America. They don't want to be doing this. And so, you know, that's one thing okay. that I take away from it.
All right. A lot in the story in the New Yorker magazine, including involvement in this controversy by the vice president's office. We really don't have time to talk about that on this program, but that is part of the story. I do want to go, as I indicated, to the report by the envoys to the United Nations. Maggie Farley is United Nations correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She's been listening to this conversation. And Maggie Farley, thanks for your patience and thanks for being with us. Tell us a bit, if you will, about what these five envoys have found. They didn't go to Guantanamo Bay. The administration has said that, consequently, they may not know what they're talking about. Let's start there.
They tried for about a year and a half to get permission to go to Guantanamo Bay and talk to the prisoners directly to follow up on some of these allegations they've been hearing about inhumane treatment. But the United States denied them special access to the prisoners, would only allow them to take sort of a guided tour of the facility like journalists or Congress members do. And so there's a lot of debate about their decision not to go to Guantanamo Bay, but they decided that it would lend the place the United Nations legitimacy if they were to go there and write a report. Some people say that it would have made their report stronger had they gone there and still concluded, even without talking to the detainees, but to the detainees' lawyers and former detainees, if they had gone there and concluded that some of these treatments and interrogation practices amounted to torture, which is one of the key findings in the UN report.
They did say that. What were their sources?
Former detainees who've been released, detainees' lawyers, who are the only ones who can talk directly to the detainees and then discuss it all publicly. The ICRC, the International Red Cross, can have access to the prisoners, but they are bound by a confidentiality agreement with the United States.
So those were their sources. They made their report. What now is the status of that report?
It will be introduced in the next session of the Human Rights Commission, the UN Human Rights Commission in Geneva, starting in March. And then there might be a resolution about it. But the report and if a resulting resolution, neither are legally binding. So what it really has is some sort of moral gravity that adds to the international moral pressure.
There are a lot of people who say the Human Rights Commission doesn't have any moral gravity because it has in its members, in its membership, and sometimes as the head of it, countries that are well-known violators of human rights. Is there any way to get around that criticism?
Yes, that's true, and it's important because it's all about to change. In fact, tomorrow, I think there will be an announcement from the United Nations that the Human Rights Commission that has been so discredited is going to be replaced by a Human Rights Council that's a little bit smaller, and there are voluntary standards for membership. And the whole idea is to try to winnow out the human rights abusers from actually sitting on the board and making decisions or protecting themselves from condemnation. The important thing about the rapporteurs, these five special experts, is that they are independent experts mandated by the UN but not part of the UN. They're chosen for their specialization in this case, in five areas, in torture, arbitrary detention, independence of judges and lawyers, freedom of religion, and the right to physical and mental health. So they are independent in a way, but they have the legitimacy transferred to them by the United Nations.
Okay. Maggie Farley, once again, UN correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Back to David Rifkin, once again, formerly with the Reagan and first Bush administrations. Do you take seriously this report from the UN?
No, quite frankly, I don't. As you mentioned a little bit earlier, this commission, the Human Rights Commission, elects any credibility, and I actually speak with a position of some knowledge here since I'm a U.S. representative to the Subcommission on the Protection and Promotion of Human Rights, which is an expert body serving the commission. These are the people, in addition to their questionable composition, who cannot find it themselves to issue a report critical of Syria, for God's sake, or Cuba. I mean, they're hypocrites. They are anti-American to the point where their judgment on all those issues is clouded. Frankly, given the source, would not take it very seriously at all.
But Maggie Farley, as I understand it, you say that these experts were independent. Were they in some way independent of the commission itself and its lack of action of the sort that David Rifkin points to?
It's not the same people, obviously. The commission is paralyzed by politics, and that's why these people are appointed independently. And the interesting question is, what is going to happen to them when the commission becomes the council? And right now the assumption is that the assignments, the appointments of the rapporteurs will just roll over. They're appointed for 3 to 6 years.
But what are their personal – we can't go into all of them, but what, roughly speaking, are their personal qualifications?
Most of them are lawyers or professors or people with some special expertise in their particular area that are sort of roundly well-respected.
Mm-hmm. Okay. David Rifkin, does that help?
No, I can tell you. I've been going to the subcommission meetings for 3 years. There are 26 of us. We're supposed to be independent experts. Two-thirds of the people on the subcommission, in addition to being professors, et cetera, are government officials. It's absurd. There's absolutely nothing independent about most people.
Okay. David Cole, back to you, professor of law, Georgetown University, legal affairs correspondent at The Nation. Do you take seriously this report?
I do, and I don't think it's really appropriate to attack the messenger, because the message that the UN report sets forth here is not unique position that no one else has taken. It's a position that I think much of the world agrees with, including some of our closest allies. England is one of the biggest critics of the way we are treating people at Guantanamo and the way we've proceeded there. We have to pay attention to this. I mean, before 9/11. The United States was the world's leader in human rights. We were exporting our experts to advise other countries on how to preserve human rights. Today, we are the focal point of so much human rights condemnation. It's because this administration, as I suggested before, without thinking about the long-term consequences, decided that all bets were off, the gloves had to come off in the war on terror. And I think the long-term consequence of that is that we have fueled an unprecedented level of anti-Americanism, which in the long term is the greatest threat to our national security.
David Rifkin, we're just about out of time. Tony Blair and Angela Merkel of Germany have both indicated they think ultimately, and perhaps sooner rather than later, Guantanamo Bay should be shut down, as the UN report suggests. What do you say to what we just heard from David Cole about the U.S.'s reputation?
I think David is right. There's a lot of anti-Americanism. I do not know, frankly, how much to attribute it to a record on detention and how much to attribute to our record in a variety of other areas that people do not like. All I can tell you is this. In my opinion, our overall detention policy has been very, very good. Compares favorably with that of any other country in any other war, including World War One and World War Two, that everybody thinks as great wars. Some individual abuses, but by and large, very humane, very robust prosecutions of individuals who've committed violations. There's just been enormous distortion and enormous degree of hostility towards American policy. And frankly, very quickly for your listeners, what does it mean to close Guantanamo? It's not a question of closing Guantanamo and putting people somewhere up in Arizona or some other place. We have a fundamental disagreement about the applicability of traditional laws of war to conditions of detention, to treatment of unlawful enemy combatants. And people, the critics basically want us process them as criminal defendants and let them go. That way lies disaster and defeat for the United States and most of a civilized world, and that cannot be
okay.
done.
Fundamental disagreement is the term, even within the Bush Pentagon, at least while Alberto Mora was there. Apparently others there felt the same way that he did. We'll certainly be hearing more about this story as time goes on. Thanks to all of you for being with us. David Rifkin, formerly with the Department of Justice and in the White House, Reagan and first Bush administrations. David Cole, professor, Georgetown University, legal affairs correspondent at The Nation. Maggie Farley, United Nations correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, and Jane Mayer, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. With two new members on board, the U.S. Supreme Court will consider the constitutionality of late-term abortion. That'll be sometime next fall. Today, it's hearing what could reverse decades of environmental regulations based on the Clean Water Act. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're Manelny back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. With Justice Samuel Alito and Chief Justice John Roberts now firmly in place, a new U.S. Supreme Court is getting down to business. Today it heard arguments challenging the Clean Water Act as the basis for regulating development on private land. David Savage covers the court for the Los Angeles Times. David, good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren.
The term navigable waters seems to be very important in this case.
Yes. The law says you may not discharge pollutants into the navigable waters of the United States. And this case is a sort of test as to what does that simple phrase mean. For about the last 30 years, the government has said that if you put pollution into a wetland or a tiny stream 30 or 50 miles from, say, the Mississippi River or the Great Lakes, we, the federal government, can stop you to do that, from doing that, because putting pollution upstream could affect the navigable waters downstream. This case is sort of a property rights case that says the federal government really doesn't have the power to prohibit farmers, for example, from filling in low-lying wetlands on their fields. That's really way beyond navigable waters, and the federal power just doesn't go up that far.
What kind of questions were asked today by the two new justices?
John Roberts asked a lot of questions, and I think he's very skeptical of the Bush administration's argument for preserving the environmental laws. He kept saying, do you mean to say that, like, if one drop of water from 50 miles away flows down to the Great Lakes, that the federal government could regulate a farmer's field 50 miles from the Great Lakes? So I think he's quite skeptical of it. Sam Alito asked one question early on, just trying to get a sense of what the arguments were in the case, but for the rest of the time, he just sat silently.
I haven't heard anything from him as yet. When Chief Justice Roberts asked a question like that, how did the lawyer for the Bush administration, Solicitor General, answer that?
He tried as best he can to say that if you allow pollution one drop of water at a time into streams, they're going to flow into the, you know, Santa Monica Bay or the Great Lakes or whatever, that the only way to make waters clean, our navigable waters clean, is to stop pollution at its source. So you have to read the law very broadly. My guess is, you would ask about Sam Alito, I think he'll be the deciding vote in this case. I think four of the justices, the liberal justices, will uphold the broad view of the law for the last 30 years. I think it's pretty clear the other four more conservative ones, including Roberts, are going to say interior wetlands way far away from a navigable water are not covered, and if Sam Alito joins them, they'll have five for a majority.
Anything in his history as an appellate to judge or otherwise that might suggest how he would vote?
Just snippets. He was in the Reagan administration. The Reagan administration believed in putting limits on the federal environmental laws, and a few times as a lower court judge, he also sort of spoke up for the idea of putting limits on the reach of federal power.
Talking to David Savage, Los Angeles Times reporter covering the U.S. Supreme Court. What now about the case that they agreed today to take having to do with late-term abortion?
You know, I think it's the same. I think the four liberal justices will say and have said that the government cannot regulate abortion in a way that might endanger the health of some women. I think the four conservative justices, including John Roberts, will say this is a reasonable restriction on abortion, and if Sam Alito is with them, they will have five. This is a dispute about how doctors perform abortions during the midterm, fourth, fifth month of a pregnancy. Even though it's always called a late-term abortion procedure, the court has not upheld the use of this abortion method after 6 months of a pregnancy. This is about midterm abortions and how they are performed.
And what we're looking at here is a federal law that prohibits late-term abortion but doesn't have a provision for the health of the mother. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. The court struck down a similar law from Nebraska 5 years ago and said the problem with this abortion ban is that some doctors say this way of performing abortions, there's less chance of bleeding, less chance of infection. It's a safer way for the women. And you, the state, or you, the federal government, cannot regulate abortion in a way that endangers the health of some women. Congress nonetheless went ahead and passed the same law as a federal law. And so now the issue is back before the Supreme Court.
And you think then that it's likely that it will split 4-4 with Alito to be the swing vote on whether or not the health of the mother is an, or ought to be a part of the law.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I must say that when Congress passed this law, the members of Congress said, it's our judgment that this abortion procedure is not needed, and therefore it won't affect. There are other ways to do abortions, and it's not needed, and therefore it won't affect the health of women. A lot of medical experts disagree with that, but that's what Congress says, and the Bush administration lawyers say, you ought to listen to Congress. Don't pay attention to all these medical experts.
Okay, and that case will be heard when?
Probably early October.
All right, we will see what happens to that and, of course, to the Clean Water Act. In the meantime, David Savage, as always, good to talk with you.
Thank you, Warren.
Los Angeles Times reporter covering the U.S. Supreme Court. Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Jonah King and Andrea Brody, Technical Director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.